Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In Rome today, Pope Benedict XVI installed his first group of cardinals, placing crimson hats upon their heads during a ceremony in Vatican City. Among the new princes of the church, two Americans, Boston's Archbishop Sean O'Malley and William Levada, former Archbishop of San Francisco and Portland, Oregon. Levada now holds Pope Benedict's old job as the Vatican's chief doctrinal watchdog. Well, Boston Globe reporter Michael Paulson is in Rome. He joins us on his cell phone. And Michael, do I understand you're actually in the Pope's home?
The formal name of the building is the Apostolic Palace. The Pope lives on the third floor, two floors down in a room that he normally uses to greet diplomats. It's this fantastically over-the-top Baroque room with enormous vaulted ceilings and highly decorated. And both of the new American cardinals, O'Malley and Levada, are in the room greeting long lines of well-wishers.
Well, I'm sure everything there is civil and celebratory, but I'm wondering, both of those men are facing tough issues, and their church is, here in the States, issues of priest sex abuse and gay adoption. Were any of those issues raised in any way today in Rome, you know, outside with protesters or inside with questions?
No, certainly not at the consistory, which was the event this morning at which they were made cardinals. The Pope gave a homily in which he didn't refer to any contemporary issues. And really, this week has been relatively celebratory. I've been following Archbishop O'Malley for the last several days, and each time he meets with the media, there are questions about those subjects, but they don't come up other than from the media here at the Vatican.
Yeah, we understand the night before, the Pope summoned all the cardinals, old and new, and soon to be new, for what sounded like an interesting meeting on topics ranging from Islam to what? What was brought up?
He has said that he wants the cardinals to function as a kind of senate, a kind of advisory body for him. And so they talked about issues facing the church, but they were issues that he outlined in advance. For example, relationships with Orthodox Christians and relationships with Islam.
And relationships with other Catholics. We understand the topic came up of perhaps reconciling with an ultra-conservative group whose bishops were excommunicated two decades ago.
This Pope has expressed some interest in trying to reconcile with the group you mentioned, which has not recognized the changes in the church since Vatican II. And he was sounding out the cardinals about how they would feel about the possibility of some kind of reconciliation.
Hmm. Well, and tell us, as these new cardinals receive their hats, symbolic of their new role, what message, what symbolic message is the Pope sending to the world with his choices?
There are 15 of them, only 12 of whom are of voting age, and many of them hold offices that entitled them to be cardinal. But certainly there were a couple that send messages. The two that come to mind are the Bishop of Hong Kong. He's been an outspoken critic of the lack of religious freedom in China. So it's the Pope trying to signal that he's unhappy with the way that China is handling the Catholic Church. And the other kind of message-sending pick, of course, was Archbishop O'Malley of Boston. And the message that he sends there is that Boston, despite the crises of the last several years, despite all the unhappiness, remains a very important see in the Catholic Church nationally and internationally. And also, it signals an endorsement by the Pope of the way that Archbishop O'Malley is handling all the controversies.
And for those who are outside of the Boston area, the controversies include closing several schools and churches to help defray some of the costs of the recent pre-sex abuse crisis.
That's right. Archbishop O'Malley arrived in Boston in the summer of 2003 in the midst of an enormous crisis caused by sexual abuse of children by priests. He wound up selling the archbishop's mansion, settling with hundreds of victims for tens of millions of dollars. He then launched a round of parish closings in which 62 parishes have closed. The archdiocese is in financial crisis, which it's trying to reconcile. It's facing the possible further closings of more schools. There's a lot of challenges facing the archdiocese and a lot of unhappiness, which he has to deal with when he gets back.
Boston Globe reporter Michael Paulson in Rome, in fact, in the Pope's home, covering the installation of the new cardinals today. They'll receive their rings during Mass in St. Peter's Square tomorrow. And Michael, you had said that only a handful of these selections are of voting age. You meant what?
Cardinals up until the age of 80 are allowed to vote in an election for a pope. 12 of the 15 are under age 80, which means when this pope dies, they can participate in the election of his successor.
Michael, thanks so much.
Sure. Take care.
Well, President Bush spent the past week trying to convince the American public that he has a plan for victory in Iraq. Today, with an eye towards this year's congressional midterm elections, he hits the campaign trail for his party, publicly appearing with a freshman congressman from Indiana, but meeting behind closed doors with Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, one of the most electorally vulnerable Republicans in Congress. The president will attend a private fundraising dinner tonight for Santorum. No pictures allowed. Well, why isn't Santorum, one of the leading conservatives in the Senate, eager to be seen hand held aloft with a sitting president, a standard campaign photo op? In the coming weeks, we're going to take a look at some of the most contested congressional races, but today, Pennsylvania. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dick Pohlman, national political analyst for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. And we also have here in the studio with us Boston University history professor Julian Zelitzer, who is an expert on presidential and congressional politics. And Julian, we're going to check in with you as well.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, and Dick, but I want to start with you first with a little bit more about this race in Pennsylvania. Let's start with Senator Rick Santorum. And remind us, why is this one of the most watched re-election races in the country?
Well, Senator Santorum is very vulnerable right now. The state is sort of considered a swing state in some ways, but it has voted for against President Bush when he was candidate Bush in 2000, and he voted against him in 2004, and primarily because of Iraq. His popularity in Pennsylvania is down and dropping, and Senator Santorum is in this very difficult position of needing to sort of stick by his president because the loyalists in Pennsylvania, the conservative voters, are still largely behind President Bush. But at the same time, the swing voters in Pennsylvania, many of whom live in the very populated Philadelphia suburbs, are not happy with the president, and yet Santorum needs a good chunk of them to win. I mean, in some ways, Pennsylvania is ground zero for the entire national landscape of Senate races this year. I mean, the Democrats can't win the Senate back unless they defeat Santorum. I mean, he's sort of the first stop on the road.
So Santorum has been saying things, again, with an eye perhaps on President Bush's falling poll numbers, but also because he's very, you know, very clear about his ideology. He was an early critic of the Dubai port deal. He said the pre-war intelligence was flawed. President should have done a better job sooner defining the war in Iraq. And here they are meeting behind closed doors. I mean, what else does that point to, the fact that they're not going out for that big photo op?
Well, it's not to Santorum's advantage to have a picture of him and Bush chumming it up posted on Democratic websites and political websites. You know, he has said some of the things that you just mentioned, but he's also... He can't make a break with the president, and it's put him in a very difficult position. There's been a number of times lately where he hasn't shown up at all when the president has come to Pennsylvania. But he needs the president still has fundraising prowess within the loyalist Republican community.
Huge prowess.
Santorum still needs the money.
Needs the money. Well, and tell us a little bit before we get a broader picture from Julian.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about Santorum's opponent, Bob Casey Jr., the state treasurer, being closely watched by Democrats.
Yes, I mean, Santorum is down in the polls to Bob Casey, at least 10 points or more right now. And I keep telling everybody that that's going to tighten up. And then one of the reasons is that Casey's like a brand name in Pennsylvania because his father was a popular governor, his late father.
We also should add for our national audience, it's familiar to them as well because his late father, the Pennsylvania governor, Robert Casey, that name is attached to the landmark abortion case, which was heard by the Supreme Court in 92, which upheld a state's right to restrict abortions in certain ways, parental notification, other requirements, as Casey required. And just to give a little of this background, this got then-Governor and Democrat Bob Casey in a lot of trouble with the party because he was putting restrictions on abortion.
Yes, well, and that's very well put because that's part of the issue now, is that his son, Bob Casey Jr., is very strongly anti-abortion. And the Democrats nationally, you know, they're trying to broaden out the party. They don't want everybody just coming from sort of the pro-choice community. And so they recruited him. And basically, there's a lot of people. There's a lot of liberal voters, a lot of people who care a lot about the choice issue, as they would frame it, who are not happy with the fact that Casey's the candidate. And so the danger here is that the Democrats will not get all of their base strongly behind Casey when it comes down to vote. I mean, in other words, that in some ways is a bit of an opportunity for Santorum to recoup.
Mm. Well, let's broaden our conversation a little and bring in BU history professor Julian Zelitzer, who usually gives us a bigger framework to look at these things. For your thoughts on the Santorum race and how it figures in the national picture.
I think it is a very representative race, and it's an actual crucial race just in terms of numbers. In terms of numbers, Democrats are scrambling to gain any seat that they can, even though there's a lot of discontent with the president, with the White House, even though in midterm elections you often have had big swings. In the current era of high rates of incumbency and in the House with gerrymandering, you don't have many seats that are open. So the Santorum is extremely important. They need that number, and they need the symbolic win of knocking off a guy who has been at the center of the Republican Revolution. So on both fronts, it's quite important.
Even though the irony would be they might knock him off, as you put it, with a guy who actually is aligned with Santorum in many ways.
Well, I think that's actually another interesting part of the race. I mean, I think what we've heard are the Democrats are kind of scrambling. What should their message be? Should they adjust on certain cultural issues? And here's a Democrat who doesn't line up very squarely on this issue of abortion. So I think people are watching him, not just to see if he can win, but if he wins, what does that mean for the national party?
And by the way, you know, for listeners, Julian, who are saying, this isn't until November, you know, these midterm elections. Are we too early in talking about this? Or do you think this time, you know, as we watch people either, you know, race to be with the president or run from the president, is this telling?
Yeah, it is telling. I mean, it's not too early in that the politicians are thinking about it, and you see the political fights beginning, and people are starting to define what each party is going to be about and how they see the president. But we still have many months to go.
Dick Pohlman, give us your view, too. What are some of the things that you're seeing, you know, nationally that are of interest to you? Right there in your neighborhood, we noted this week, Dick Cheney made a speech, and a prominent politician and candidate in New Jersey got lost in traffic, and the Democrats had a field day with that, you know, saying, was he just afraid of being seen with the vice president?
Well, that's important. That incident is important. That's Tom Kane Jr., another example of someone from a political family. I mean, the Kane brand name is very popular among Republicans in New Jersey because of his father, Tom Kane, who was governor and also, you know, co-helmed the 9/11 commission. Mm-hmm. But Tom Kane Jr., you know, sort of a moderate Republican, there's still many of them in New Jersey, he's running for the Senate. The point being that Dick Cheney and President Bush are extremely unpopular in New Jersey, maybe arguably more there than almost any other state.
Well, Dick Pohlman, hold that intriguing thought. Dick is national political analyst for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're going to take a break, and both Dick and Boston University history professor Julian Zelitzer will be back in a moment to explain that comment about New Jersey, but also talk more about whether Republicans and Democrats both can hold their bases together into November. Stay with us. You're listening to Here and Now. Contested congressional races in the country, the re-election campaign of Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania. He's the third-ranking Republican in the Senate, a leading conservative, and he's being challenged by a Democrat who opposes abortion. Well, we're joined again from Pennsylvania by Dick Pohlman, national political analyst for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and here in the studio by BU history professor Julian Zelitzer. And Julian, picking up on Dick's point before the break, that approval ratings for President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney are very low, hovering at 30%. But aren't they still hugely popular with their conservative base?
Well, I mean, actually, there's been a different report. He actually slipped President Bush ever since, you know, even before Harriet Myers, he was starting to slip into a little dangerous territory with his own base. Part of what the Supreme Court nominations were about after Myers were to shore up that base. I think it's still strong, but I'm not sure it's overwhelmingly strong. And I think there's a little uncertainty that even a conservative such as Santorum must be getting nervous about. I don't think the hardcore Republican Party is in love with George Bush anymore, President Bush, for many reasons. But I don't think it's that solid.
Well, but Dick, I'm looking at an AP Ipsos poll that showed Bush holding a 74% approval rating among Republicans compared with the 37% overall in that poll.
Right. But for point of comparison, if we're talking about over, the, say, 3 years ago, President Bush was pulling over 90% among Republicans. There has been a drop. I mean, that's appreciable in the sense that it asks the question, can a Republican candidate win a statewide race like a Senate race with only your base and hardly anybody else, and particularly at a time when your base is not as strong and as united as it was. And I mean, I think what we're going to see next week, for example, in the Senate, there's going to be a major battle over immigration. And this is an issue where President Bush and many senators are actually to the left of the conservative base. You know, they want to emphasize guest worker programs for the 11 million illegal immigrants to at least stay here on some level. And the conservative base is, I've heard this in rhetoric, they basically think he's soft on national security because he won't secure, in their minds, the border.
I think, I mean, in addition to these fights over immigration and spending, you have a certain amount of uncertainty over the next few months that both conservatives and moderates are nervous about. With the war in Iraq, there's this question, you know, literally, how will it unfold? What's going to happen in August? What's going to happen in September? And that makes politicians nervous if they feel that we're in a moment when you can't predict what's going to happen politically. And the second issue is, of course, corruption. That has been an issue that has dominated Capitol Hill. Santorum has been at the center of that as well.
I mean, explain. You're talking about...
Well, we've had the Jack Abramoff scandal.
Lobbying.
Santorum clearly is close to Jack Abramoff. He's been part of the K Street connection, as are other Republicans who are dealing with this. Conrad Burns in Montana is another Republican who is nervous about this. And corruption stories are hard to predict. Who knows what charges are going to come out next month?
And, Dick, you've written that the GOP's message to try to win these swing voters is change the subject, given what we've been saying about the concern about the war and the unknown of the lobbying scandal. Is that what you mean? Change it to something other than that?
Well, yes, change it to, you know, what would the Democrats do? Would the Democrats be worse? Would the Democrats raise your taxes or something like that? I mean, I think that's what they're going to say. But I think, you know, I mean, I think Julian might agree on this, is that this is the sixth year of a presidential administration. And generally speaking, by then, the burden really is on the incumbent party to successfully defend its record. And it's hard sometimes to change the subject.
And, Julian, do Democrats have an effective counter message?
I don't think they have one yet. I think so far they've had a negative message. We are not the party of corruption. We are not the party of Iraq. They're going to need something both nationally and in these races. But they have time. The Democrats are going to need something. It is a referendum on Bush, but I think in the swing states they're going to want to know what the alternative is.
Julian Zelitzer of Boston University and Dick Pohlman, national political analyst for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you to you both. Well, we want to take a couple minutes now for a remembrance. The opera world was saddened to learn today of the death of conductor Sarah Caldwell, the first woman to conduct at the Metropolitan Opera. Joining us now is Linda Cabot-Black. She's now with Boston's Lyric Opera, but with Sarah Caldwell, founded the Opera Company of Boston in 1958. And Linda, I know this is a big loss for you personally, for the opera world. I'm looking at a picture of Sarah Caldwell on the cover of Time magazine in 1975. The headline reads...
Oh, I have it.
You have it right there. The headline yeah. reads, Music's Wonder Woman. Why? Why was she such a Wonder Woman?
Well, opera was a pretty traditional art form in those days. There were only four companies, essentially, in this country, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, and New York. And the Metropolitan toured all over the country and pretty much dominated everything. And she began doing these productions that were unusual, rare, innovative. She demanded high acting skills of the singers. So in the end, she really transformed the whole face of the art form, especially in this country.
She was the first woman to conduct at the Metropolitan Opera, as we said. How important a moment was that?
Well, it was important for her, but it was not important for us. She didn't do particularly good work in New York or anywhere else outside of Boston. She had a modus operandi that she said she could only do good work if she controlled everything from soup to nuts.
Well, this is reminding us, Linda, that she was a complicated person.
Oh, yeah. Like most artists, I suppose.
Yeah.
And people assumed that she was just artistic with her head in the clouds. That's not really true. She was a very smart woman, very, very smart. She grew up as a mathematician, actually, and then went into string playing and then opera. So it wasn't that she was had her head in the clouds. She was just so stubborn about putting every single resource into whatever the next production was that it was impossible to build a healthy company under her.
And it was difficult. She had her difficulties here in Boston at the Opera House in particular. But, Linda, we'll be hearing much more during the day. In the few seconds we have, what else should we know about Sarah Caldwell?
Well, I think she transformed the art form. There are now well over 100, 150 companies in this country. Every city in the country has an opera of some kind. And that's really due to her. Her and the introduction of Sir titles so that people really know what they're hearing.
Linda Cabot-Black, now with Boston's Lyric Opera, on the passing of opera great Sarah Caldwell yesterday at 82. Linda, thanks so much.
Sure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is...
I promise this will be the most ridiculous thing you've ever heard. Here goes. How about taking the summer off to see what it might be like around here without all the shooting and killing? Serious. How about a ceasefire? A little break could save lives, maybe even your own.
That's Baltimore Sun columnist Dan Rodericks reading from his article, Dealers Deal If You Must, But Please Stop the Killing. Rodericks says he wrote the piece in a moment of desperation last June because after 26 years of writing for the paper, he was fed up writing about drugs and violence. His direct appeal to drug dealers included his phone number and an offer to help anyone go straight and get a job. Well, so far, about 1,200 people have called to take him up on it. Dan Rodericks joins us now on the line from the Baltimore Sun. And Dan, when you first wrote this column, I'm guessing that there are people who had a field day criticizing it.
Oh, yeah. The first day it was widely ridiculed. Even some of my friends thought I was just grandstanding and having a little fun. Most people thought that it was ridiculous indeed because drug dealers don't read the newspaper.
So when did the first calls come in?
About 4:30 a.m. the day the column appeared, and that was from a man who had been a drug dealer who was trying to go straight and was having a tough time making enough money to support his wife and two children. You know, that first day there were about 21 phone calls, and the next day another 21, and then 30 the next day, and then 40 the next day, and you hear that phone. I don't know if you heard that. My phone just went off because that's a cell phone the Baltimore Sun gave me to use for this purpose. And it has been ringing. It rings every, 20 minutes or so, every 30 minutes. I can't keep track of it, really. There's a lot of men out there who want to get out of this life and find a job. They're unemployed.
So what have you done? What do you do? Because you're not a social worker.
No, I'm not. But actually, I've had an ongoing conversation with these guys since last June. This has been the most rewarding year of my life in terms of just personal interaction with people, learning to understand how people live and work and function in this life. Baltimore has had a long, dismal cycle of heroin and homicide. And we've written about it, reported on it, but we've never really, I feel like I've never really done anything about it. So what I did was refer most of these guys to the few good agencies in Baltimore that are focused on finding jobs for ex-offenders. I've also referred some to specific jobs because I've gotten a lot of job leads, companies that are willing to hire ex-offenders.
We understand one of the job programs is run by Goodwill Services. It's the Supporting Ex-Offenders in Employment, Training, and Transitional Services. Have they placed anyone?
Oh, yeah. They tell me they've placed anywhere from 40 to 50 people on my referrals. But, I've referred 400 or 500, so whatever percentage that is, Some people don't follow up. They make the one phone call, and you can tell when you're talking to them whether they're earnest or not, or whether they're still using or not. I'm at the point now where I can tell just from voice vibes someone who's still doing heroin or cocaine or someone who isn't. a lot of the smarter, quote-unquote smarter drug dealers never used their own stuff, but they just went into business here because there was nothing else for them to do at the age of 16 or 17. They got sucked into that life and made a decent living from it.
Well, you know, this is what some of your critics have said of you, though, of that thinking, that this is a kind of simplistic, you know, kumbaya moment, I think someone referred to it as. Do you really think it's just that, Dan, that literally somebody got trapped in something as a young person and didn't know how to get out until they picked up a newspaper column? I mean, is it really that simple?
There's this expression, you don't know what you don't know, and I didn't know what I didn't know about this world. This is very real. Young men grow up in Baltimore. They drop out of school, and some 50 or 60% of them do. 40 years ago, their fathers or uncles would have been able to been an unskilled man, go to work in a steel mill, make a decent living, a union wage, get a pension, have a house, have a car, have a nuclear family. It doesn't work like this here. We're talking about people who are stuck in this poverty cycle where there are no jobs like that, okay? And it's very real. Somebody has better clothes. Somebody has a car. Somebody can support their mother by selling drugs.
Well,
I just want to say one thing about the kumbaya stuff. You know, I'm not a kumbaya guy. I just think, you know, after writing about something for so many years and talking about it, it was time to actually do something.
Studies show about half of all black men in inner cities don't finish high school. 72% of black men who are high school dropouts are unemployed because the factory jobs that used to be there for unskilled workers have dropped off dramatically. So given that, and given that that's what you say you've seen in Baltimore, what jobs are these young dropouts getting?
That's a good question. The jobs I'm referring guys to are entry-level jobs that pay, you know, $7 to $10 an hour. So the people who are calling me, Robin, are people who are motivated to change. They know they're not going to make as much money as they used to. A guy who called me today, his name is Eric. He's 31 years old. He's been selling drugs since he was 17. He wants to get out. He owes somebody $1,800, and he's going to be in trouble if he doesn't pay off this debt to the other drug dealers. So they're kind of forcing him to go back to the street to make up for that debt. But he called me because he's afraid of something. He's afraid of going to prison again. The police in Baltimore have been really cracking down on the corners. It's harder to do this nowadays than it used to be. He has a child. So I don't think the ones who are calling, it's not like I'm going out on the street corner and tapping them on the shoulder and say, brother, I want to save you. You know, they're calling me. They're taking some action. They're picking up the phone. There's some motivation there. And they're going to settle for less. They're not going to make as much money, but they're also not going to go to prison, and they're not going to get a bullet in their head.
So, Dan, how long do you think you're going to keep this going?
I kept looking for places, you know, to get off the train, because I'm sure there's a lot of people who don't care about this. And I did get some mail from people who said, dear Dan, I really miss your column. You know, why are you writing this stuff? I don't care about it. But I've got, for every one of those, there's 10 or 12 emails from people, suburban, white people, who look at this and say, it's intractable. It can never be changed. It's a lost cause. But I think they appreciate the effort. And every time I write a story, like yesterday's story, about somebody who gets out of the life, finds a job, settles down, you know, gets in a groove, a good groove again, that gives you optimism, gives you some hope that they can change. And I think this guy, Eric, who called me today, called because of yesterday's story. Yesterday's story was about a guy who got out of prison, decided not to go back to being a drug dealer, and has a job now and is supporting a wife and child.
So each success begets more.
Yeah.
Dan Roderick's columnist and sort of, you know, employment agency. but we'd love to check back with you and see how many of them can stay. How many of them can stay out of the drug dealer life. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And much of what Dan Roderick says he found anecdotally is supported by a new series of studies on black men. Columbia University professor Ron Mincy says black men are left behind in school and left out of the workplace in part for cultural reasons.
Black male youth culture is one of the biggest selling phenomena that we've experienced in this decade, not only in the United States, but all over the world.
You mean their hip-hop and their low-slung
the
pants?
The hip-hop, the dress, the swagger. However, that behavior may be off-putting in a setting where you're dealing with adults and where you're dealing with people who are not from the same subculture. Mm-hmm. So you honor that aggression, but when you're served at the counter, you may be intimidated by that.
So are they not being hired
for the same look they're being applauded for. Join us Monday for the rest of our conversation with Professor Ron Mincy on why so many young blacks are not working and what to do about it. You're listening to Here and Now. Army Sergeant Corey Dan will be laid to rest in the town of Norway, Maine tomorrow. Sergeant Dan was killed in Iraq on March 13th when a roadside bomb hit the Humvee he was riding in. He died having never seen his newborn son. In addition to mourners at Sergeant Dan's funeral, there will be picketers from the Westboro Baptist Church of Topeka, Kansas. They'll be holding signs saying, "Thank God for Dead Soldiers." Church members have protested at funerals in 35 states, saying war casualties are God's wrath for America's tolerance of homosexuality. They also hold signs saying God hates fags. This week, the Maryland legislature took a first step to stopping these protests by approving a bill in the House of Delegates to ban funeral protests. We're joined now by State Delegate Mary Delaney James, a Democrat from Havre de Grace, who's the bill's sponsor. And Delegate James, what prompted you, first of all, to submit this bill?
Well, I represent an area that has a very large military facility, and obviously we have a lot of military personnel and veterans in the area. They wrote to me before it became really nationally known that these picketers were going around and brought to my attention that they were absolutely disturbing and harming families who were trying to bury their fallen military men and women. So I went ahead and put the bill in order to protect the sanctity of those kinds of memorial services.
We understand they showed up at a soldier's funeral in Westminster, Maryland, this month.
That was a very dark day in Maryland's history. However, the bright lining is that really ensured that the bill passed out of the House of Delegates. So we really got a lot of momentum out of what is otherwise a terrible tragedy.
And by the way, your House of Delegates is like many people's House of Representatives. And tell us, what will this law do?
Well, this law will strike, I think, a very fair balance between the right of free speech protected under the Constitution and the rights of states to protect the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens, as well as preserving the peace and protecting people's privacy. And it does that by saying that you cannot obstruct or impede someone's ability to go to a funeral or burial, and also you cannot conduct what we call hate speech, speech that's devoid of any real ideas, but is otherwise likely to incite or produce an imminent breach of the peace. And saying thank God for IEDs, which are the improvised explosive devices that kill our men and women in Iraq, is the kind of hate speech that I don't believe is protected, and nor does our Attorney General.
And you can't have this kind of speech within 300 feet of a funeral or a funeral procession. And we understand several states have already passed similar laws, and Republican Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan plans to introduce a measure on the national level.
Yes.
But my question to you is related to free speech, and three of your fellow delegates have asked the same question. No matter how offensive these protesters are, shouldn't their speech be protected?
Well, hate speech has never been fully protected. Free speech is designed for the exchange of differing ideas, and you can be passionate and you can be animated, but if you're just saying, "I hate you," over and over again, you're not advancing an idea, you're advancing an emotion. And that really doesn't fall under the Founding Fathers' concept of free speech. So we can regulate it. It's been regulated many, many times in the past. And this bill, obviously, I think, is consistent with Supreme Court law and the First Amendment rights that are out there.
Which is why perhaps the KKK, for instance, and other groups do have the right to protest.
Oh, absolutely. And this group can protest, too, I suppose, at forums other than those that involve funeral services, and you're an extremely vulnerable emotional and physical time when you're burying your loved one. We have a right to protect those people, and that has to be paramount.
This is the same group that has protested at the funeral of AIDS victims and at Matthew Shepard's funeral.
As well as the 12 coal miners that died at the Sago Mine disaster in West Virginia.
Would your law prevent those kinds of protests as well, or is it just
military
funerals?
It's not confined to military funerals, because that would really elevate one group of mourners over another. And obviously, when I learned that they go everywhere, I said, no funeral should ever be disrupted like this. There ought to be a time to bury your dead. It's like a religious ceremony. You're not allowed to interrupt a religious ceremony either on the grounds of free speech. You have to give people the right to privacy and the right to bury their loved ones.
Delegate James, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Maryland State Delegate Mary Delaney James sponsoring a bill to ban protesters at funerals. That's in response to a Topeka, Kansas church group that's been picketing military funerals because they believe God is striking down soldiers for defending the nation that tolerates homosexuality. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Has taken on some challenging topics, military spending, coal mining, genocide, and she's won a MacArthur Genius Grant for her work. Well, now she's tackling genetic research and some troubling ethical questions posed by it in a new dance called Ferocious Beauty Genome. In it, issues such as designer babies, aging, and identity are explored through movement, spoken word, and video. As part of a nationwide tour, Ferocious Beauty Genome will receive its premiere in Flint, Michigan tomorrow. The Cultural Center there co-commissioned the dance with Wesleyan University in Connecticut. That's where Here and Now's Lynn Menegon caught up with a guest performer in the piece, Suzanne Richard, who has a personal take on genetics.
I have osteogenesis imperfecta, which is brittle bones disease, which is actually a genetic mutation. It's only a mutation because no one in my family is a carrier except me now. So it was a spontaneous mutation. And I was actually in my own eighth grade science project to find out why I wasn't growing. I've had many, many broken bones, and mostly when I was younger. So I think growth was stopped every time I would break something. I had like 60 broken bones growing up. So growth would stop every time I broke, and so I just ended up a lot shorter than everybody else.
And you dance with crutches, mm-hmm. and you do some amazing things with them. You can move quickly across the stage. You can make sound with them in a way that none of the other dancers can do. You can leap through the air in surprising ways with them.
When I was little, I really wanted to be a dancer, but I had enough presence of mind to realize that, well, first of all, I couldn't get into any of the ballet classes. So I was pretty sure I wasn't going to be a dancer, so I went into theater. And I'm an actor professionally, and it's actually nice because I rarely play people with disabilities, so it's kind of fun to be representing my peeps. And I'm playing the wild genome. I don't know really what it is exactly.
The wild genome. You are the floating unknown kind of figure, or?
More of the mutation, the difference. We call it Apple.
I wanted people in their seats to have to think, well, should those dancers be able to take that kind of movement and dance with that? I mean, is that, like, okay?
That's choreographer Liz Lerman. She uses apples on stage to symbolize her concerns about genetic manipulation. Why? Partly because she partnered with the Mott family's Applewood Heritage Farm in Flint, Michigan, where scientists are trying to preserve 25 different kinds of rare apples.
I mean, once there were thousands and thousands of kinds of apples. And now, partly because we want apples at certain times of the year, and because we like red apples, we had something to do with it. We picked the red apples, and there are not so many brown apples anymore.
What physically happens on stage? Do you bring apples on stage? Do dancers roll them, throw them, eat them?
Let's see, in that section, there's a variety of movement. Some of it's like traveling, because the apples traveled from Kazakhstan. That was where apples began, and they actually took the Silk Road. So you kind of have a sense of like a journeying and a traveling. And if you cut an apple in half and you look at the core, you have those five carpels, the seeds. And there's a beautiful video of that, and then that transmorphs into five people in the place of the seeds. And they're all very diverse. And then as the dance proceeds, they become more and more until it's just one. Until it's just one person in the apple, in the five parts. And then that apple gets multiplied thousands of times on the screen, so you suddenly see like a kaleidoscope of the same person. It's very, very beautiful. And I like the fact that it's so beautiful, but I hope you're also wondering, well, what we gave up for that beauty.
Lerman didn't just involve apple researchers. She also spoke with hundreds of genetic scientists around the country and even included them in the piece on videotape.
You could start out by just laying dancers out end to end on the floor, head to foot, head to foot, head to foot.
One section is called Scientist as Choreographer. We asked the scientists to pretend that they were the choreographer and to take one of their processes and explain it in choreographic terms.
It's the genome shuffle, okay?
So if the dancers were going to do this hormone drift...
And then they would stir themselves and different groupings would occur.
It's really funny. So they're trying to explain, let's say they want to explain how a DNA replicates.
But the chromosomes are basically all the same. You can just take them and go back, and it's just a matter of shuffling and rearranging the pieces. You got it?
Turns out many scientists think that dance is an absolutely appropriate mechanism for an expression of what they're trying to do.
You wouldn't think that. How an idea, an abstract idea, can become physical. How can you do that?
Well, initially, my first take on it was that the biological processes themselves are so physical. They're tiny, so we don't think of them as physical. But one of the scientists I met from the University of Chicago was all excited because they had just hired a new geneticist, and his field was traffic patterns in a cell. And that's right. There's so much packed into these cells. That's why the dance starts with a woman with a telescope looking out. And then she turns the telescope in on her body. And that's when the stars come out. Because one of the first things I gathered as I started thinking about this is that the scale internally is just as cosmic as what we consider the universe. Is very hard to imagine. And in fact, one reason why the scientists, I think, like dancers is they themselves are trying to visualize. It's all so small.
We're all very similar.
Head to foot.
Ferocious Beauty Genome is a complex piece. Even Gregor Mendel makes an appearance on stage. Remember him from school? Liz Lerman does. He's the 19th century German monk and genetics pioneer who experimented with the genes of pea plants.
First, I was drawn to Mendel because he's my first memory. Secondly, I'm drawn to him because he died without knowing that his work was appreciated. And as an artist, I've always been thoughtful about that people who spend their whole lives, you know, obsessing and working on something and never know that it had an impact. And actually, when I got the MacArthur, I have to say that the most amazing thing about that was to feel like in my own lifetime somebody said, your work matters. It was the biggest shock about that. And in some ways, I think that's why I'm drawn back to somebody like Mendel. Also, he was so incredibly obsessive. I mean, singular, counting 19,000 peas or this, you know. And lastly, and maybe most importantly, because he's a monk. And although I think there are reasons for religion and science to be separate, and they do very different things, and I think each is very, very powerful in its own right, I think it's interesting to look for where these things can be really, really compatible. And they were very compatible in him. And I think it's important for people to understand that. It doesn't have to be. We don't have to automatically set up that religion and science will be in contradiction with each other. And I think that's a really unhealthy place for us to get to. We seem very caught in that right now. I feel like spend the night with a show like this, and you'll be stretching your muscles to help you be the kind of person I really think we need right now, which are people who are willing to interpret and reinterpret and reinterpret what's happening to us, and then I hope take some action. So it isn't so much that I want people to walk out and say, gee, I better write my congressman about genetics. It's not that. But I would love people to walk out and say, wow, I have so much to think about, and I can feel and think at the same time. I don't have to compartmentalize these things.
Here in Now's Lynn Manigan produced our piece on Ferocious Beauty Genome. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. And a quick note, earlier we spoke about the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania. We mentioned Democratic candidate Bob Casey, but we want to add that Alan Sandals and Chuck Benacchio are also running in the Democratic Party primary in May. Good luck to all. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend and join us again. Here Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here at